Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature, by Dan Senekin, narrated by Mike Lenz. Introduction. It was a Monday in late February 1990, the coldest day of the year. Andre Schifrin, a natty 54-year-old New Yorker, left Random House headquarters in Midtown to plod through the evening crowds. Wind blew down from the Hudson River, tousling his graying red hair, stinging his wide-set, mousy eyes. He shivered and pulled his overcoat tighter around himself, heading home to his wife. He had just been fired. For 28 years, he had worked at Pantheon, which his father co-founded and later sold to Random House. The younger Schifrin became Pantheon's editorial director. He petitioned Random House for autonomy, and its executives granted it. He extended his father's cosmopolitan vision, bringing European ideas to the United States. He published John Berger's G, Julio Cortazar's Hopscotch, Marguerite Duras's The Lover, and Gunter Grass's The Tin Drum. He published leftist writers, Barbara Ehrenreich, Michel Foucault, Ralph Nader, Edward Said, Studs Terkel, E.P. Thompson, who wrote history and theory imagined through the experiences of ordinary people. Schifrin fancied himself a bit of a subversive. After his daughters encouraged him to acquire his FBI file, which noted a trip of his to Cuba and his protests against the Vietnam War, he wrote a jocular essay for the New York Times, suggesting that the Bureau's surveillance adds some dignity and meaning to our efforts, to those who fear that no one has paid any attention. By all means, let us pay for more scissors and paste, more files, and more agents. How nice to know that someone outside the family will clip our every word. The enemy rises. Rumor of Schifrin's firing caught the wind, which carried it through the city. A notice appeared in the next day's Times. It spurred the kind of convergence of energies that we recognize in retrospect as an event. In coming days, Pantheon's editorial staff quit en masse. Opinion pieces were written, protests were held. In one way or another, this event touched everyone in the book world. The firing of Andre Schifrin revealed that a monumental shift had taken place, one that had begun 30 years earlier, that everyone had watched unfold in slow motion. Had tried, some of them, in fits and starts, to stop, but no one, not even the old giants, could stop it now. It would pull everyone into its vortex, dominating the creation of literature for the next 30 years and more. The enemy, according to those who rallied to Schifrin's defense, was conglomeration, which in this instance found its agent in Alberto Vitali, Random House's new president, a jowly Italian with a PhD in economics. Vitali canned Schifrin, and conglomeration was the inimical force that, in the eyes of Schifrin's defenders, had displaced publishing's cultural mandate in favor of the bottom line. Conglomeration did not stop in 1990. It continues to this day. A German conglomerate, Bertelsmann, acquired Random House in 1998, and under Bertelsmann, Random House merged with Penguin, one of the other Big Six publishers, in 2013. Through these acquisitions and mergers, a vast accumulation of historically independent houses, whose dramas are detailed in this book, have become Penguin Random House properties, among them Ballantine, Bantam, Berkeley, Crown, Dell, Dial, DK, Doubleday, Dutton, Knopf, New American Library, Putnam, Viking, and Pantheon. The books available to us today are products of the conglomerate era. As his partisans took to their pens, writing letters and op-eds in support, Schifrin, gagged by his severance agreement, waited. He waited a decade. His vengeance came cold in his passionate, if not wholly clear-sighted polemic, The Business of Books, How the International Conglomerates Took Over Publishing and Changed the Way We Read. Into the Colophon. It's true, conglomerates took over publishing and changed how and what we read, and how and what writers write. But Schifrin was still too resentful, too close to it, to seem much other than avarice. This book defers judgment about whether conglomeration was good or bad in an effort to explain what it has meant for U.S. fiction and how we should read it. Our first move requires a simple change of perspective. Publishers know that readers pay attention to a book's cover, so they invest in its design and emblazon it with what they want everyone to see, the title and the name of the author. If we turn a book 90 degrees so that we are facing its spine, then look to the bottom, we will find what is often overlooked, the publisher's mark, its colophon. Publishers take quiet pride in these. Farrar, Strauss, and Giraud's Three Fish. Knopf's Borzoi. Random House's illustration of Voltaire's Candide's house. A somewhat random house. Or Columbia University Press's Geometric Crown. For centuries, such marks have served as the publisher's promise. We affirm the quality of editing, proofreading, design, typesetting, and printing in this book. The colophon is an emblem that contains within it a collective, all the people who work to make the book we hold in our hands, but whose names we seldom know. Historically, and still sometimes today, publishers included a page at the end of books with information about how it was made. This page was also called a colophon. I want us to enter the world of the colophon, to unfetishize the commodity, to respect the author whose name adorns the front cover by returning her to the milieu from which she sprang. Our outsized attention to the author alone is a trick of history, the legacy of copyright. Authors needed to be made responsible for books if they were to collect royalties. Lawyers needed someone on whom to lay the blame for libel. If we want to know what conglomeration did to books, why books are different now than they were, then we need to unearth what conglomeration did to the people who live inside the colophon. How it took power from some and gave it to others, transformed incentives, and invented new jobs altogether. My cast of characters is vast and spans decades, and though my quarry is the system, it expresses itself through the people whose ambitions fill these chapters. Victor Waybright, a farm kid from rural Maryland who wanted the whole country to read Faulkner, at least his smuttier books. Jane Friedman, a Jewish girl from Long Island who invented the author tour, or so she told every journalist she met. Morton Janklow, a corporate securities lawyer who fought for his friend to publish a book that made Nixon look good after Watergate, and who found he liked to make publishers sweat, so he became a literary agent. They made books popular, glamorous, and costly at auction, as readers at home found Stephen King, Judith Krantz, and Danielle Steele atop the New York Times bestseller list. Agents tippled martinis at Manhattan's Four Seasons. I introduce the cast gradually, in the hope that, by the end, through the magic of accretion, you feel, like I do, the intimacy, almost the incestuousness, of this influential but hidden world. It is a competitive, dynamic world in which everyone is at all times fighting a war for position at multiple scales. Inside their own publishing house, against peer institutions, and to dominate the field as a whole. Some fight more for art, some more for money, but always, by necessity, a bit of both. Waybright had to outwit his German business partner, whom he distrusted, crush the Philistines at Bantam, Dell, Fawcett, and Pocket, and get as many of us reading Faulkner's Sanctuary and the Wild Palms as he could. The weapons are books. The battles are fought through style and voice, pacing and genre, covers and blurbs. To read a book through its colophon is to read it anew. Aesthetics double as strategy. Author and publishing house might be, often are, intention, a tension that plays out between a book's lines. The game a book plays is significantly different depending on whether its colophon is Bantam's Rooster, Doubleday's Anchor, Gray Wolf's Wolves, or W.W. Norton's Seagull, for reasons this book unfurls. I linger over books in these chapters, reading them through the Colophon's portal in light of the conglomerate era. I show how much we miss when we fall for the romance of individual genius. In novels, the conglomerate era finds its voice. Conglomeration happens, and happens. In 1959, U.S. publishers, unlike film and radio, which had been corporately run and consolidated for nearly 40 years, were relatively small and privately held, usually by the founders or their heirs. They functioned like big families, hierarchical, loyal, built on relationships. Houses. Authors might stop by to chat with editors. Editors might finagle to support an author through a bad decision or three. Dr. Seuss visited Random House to recite his latest work. Albert Erskine, an editor there, had helped keep Malcolm Lowry afloat for many years, and would soon do the same for Cormac McCarthy. Publishers were mostly located in New York City, or to a lesser degree, Boston. One set was established before the Civil War: Harper, Houghton Mifflin, as Ticknor and Fields, Little Brown, Macmillan, Scribner. A new set appeared in the 1910s and 1920s, many created by Jewish bookmen: Knopf, Random House, Simon & Schuster, Viking. Pocketbooks brought modern mass-market publishing to the United States in 1939, imitating Penguin in the UK, followed by Dell in 1943, Bantam in 1945, New American Library in 1948, and Fawcett in 1950. It, 1959, was a good time to be in the business of books. During World War II, the military shipped millions of books to soldiers, creating a vast body of readers, many of whom came home and went to college on the GI Bill. Universities expanded and kept expanding to keep up with enrollments as they opened their doors to more than white men, churning out more readers. Many classics were free to acquire from the public domain. The economy was in the midst of one of the greatest growth spurts in the history of capitalism. Beginning in 1960, houses found themselves swept up by business trends far beyond their control. People had moved from farms to cities for factory jobs, and in many cases, to escape the terror of Jim Crow. Large industrial corporations such as Ford Motor Company, General Electric, and U.S. Steel had become the organizing structure for economic and social life. They were run by bureaucratic managers who were incentivized, above all, to grow the organization, even at the expense of profitability. By 1960, many corporations had reached limits of internal growth and had to look outward. Antitrust law inhibited mergers and acquisitions within an industry, so corporations acquired in others, forming conglomerates. ITT, for example, was a telecommunications company before becoming, in the 1960s, a conglomerate that contained Sheraton Hotels, various auto parts manufacturers, the makers of Wonder Bread, a chain of vocational schools, insurance companies, and Avis Rent-A-Car. Times Mirror, a newspaper company, bought New American Library, NAL, a mass market publisher in 1960, inaugurating what I call the conglomerate era. Times Mirror hired McKinsey, a consulting firm, to restructure NAL, with dire results that I chronicle in the first chapter. The previous year, 1959, Random House became the first major house to go public and used the influx of cash to acquire Knopf in 1960. In 1961, it acquired Pantheon, hiring Andre Schifrin in 1962. In 1966, RCA, an electronics company, acquired Random House. Doubleday acquired radio and television stations in 1967 and the New York Mets in 1980. Time Inc. acquired Little Brown in 1968. A Canadian communications company acquired Macmillan in 1973. Bantam went to IFI, an Italian conglomerate that owned Fiat, the car company, in 1974. Simon & Schuster went to Gulf & Western in 1975. Fawcett to CBS in 1977. As we will discuss, it hardly stopped there. Shareholder values. It, 1977, was a bad time to be in the book business. Economic growth had stalled. Inflation hiked the price of books even as consumers had less money to buy them. Conglomerate owners, who, unlike Times Mirror, had in many cases refrained from interfering in their publishing properties, became more involved in concert with the transformation in the theory of the corporation. The old notion of the large corporation as a social institution that considered the common good was out. Executives came to treat corporations as the legal fictions they are, mere means for their one goal, increasing shareholder value. That meant executives needed to squeeze every drop from all of their properties, including publishers. Ed, bottom line Griffiths, the new president of RCA, began pressing Random House's head for quarterly growth and five-year plans. Editors had once been the uncontested suzerains of title acquisition. Their tastes drove lists, front and back. In the 1970s, however, they watched their power wane. Aggressive literary agents staged high-pressure auctions and came for subsidiary rights. Houses brought in directors dedicated to selling those rights for reprinting, translation, and film and television adaptation. Marketing departments grew and gathered influence, producing baroque campaigns of total saturation for top titles. Authors, observing these developments, became anxious. They worried that houses would focus their energies on just a few potential blockbusters by newly stratospheric brand names who could carry a budget: Stephen King, Judith Krantz, Danielle Steele. At the other end, houses hired cheap writers to crank out formulaic genre fiction or serial novelizations of popular films and TV shows. In late May 1977, Star Wars debuted in theaters, on its way to instituting the tentpole, synergistic, franchise entertainment model that would lead to the Marvel Cinematic Universe in film and endless genre series in publishing. Worst of all, authors feared that houses would abandon literature altogether for the sure bets of cookbooks and celebrity memoirs. On June 6, 1977, John Brooks, John Hersey, and Herman Woke, representing the Authors Guild, an advocacy group for professional writers, held a press conference at which they called for the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission to start proceedings that would eventually end the process of mergers and acquisitions in the book publishing industry. Woke was quoted in the Washington Post the next day, calling conglomeration a sinister process, noting that in a conglomerate, there is a narrowing down of margins of what is safe and what is publishable, given the responsibilities to shareholders. The press conference led to a Senate hearing on March 13, 1980, before the Subcommittee on Antitrust, Monopoly, and Business Rights, headed by Senator Howard M. Metzenbaum, Democrat from Ohio. In his opening remarks, Metzenbaum made his position clear, saying, "We see in the publishing business a trend that exists in too many sectors of today's economy, and that is acquisition by larger firms of their smaller competitors and the entry into diverse industries by the large conglomerates." A series of prominent writers and publishers then spoke and were questioned by senators afterward. The two groups testified fiercely in opposition to one another. E. L. Doctorow, speaking as a writer and the vice president of the American Center of Penn International, acknowledged that his own work had been published by a conglomerate, and that, in his experience with his house, attention is paid to serious works in all fields of thought: fiction, the social sciences, politics, and even to a small extent, poetry. He avoided the righteousness in evidence earlier in the proceedings in a statement by Maxwell Lilienstein, general counsel for the American Booksellers Association, who said that selling books is a unique business involving the sale of ideas that can determine the fate of civilizations. Books are not commodities to be marketed like toothpaste or soap. Doctorow, instead, averred that nobody is objecting to commerce or to making money. Publishers have always wanted to make money. Traditionally, he observed, a publishing list has always reflected the tension between the need to make money and the desire to publish well. He worried, though, that this delicate balance of pressures within a publishing firm is upset by the conglomerate that values the need for greater and greater profits, until, eventually, the need for profits overloads the scale in favor of commerce. He worried about the tendency of the publishing industry to be absorbed by the entertainment industry, with all its values of pandering to the lowest common denominator. Executives from Doubleday, Harcourt, Brace Jovanovich, and Simon & Schuster, all known for their commercialism, defended conglomeration. They pointed to the persistent growth both in the number of publishers and titles in the industry. William Jovanovich showed no patience for arguments that publishers should look beyond the bottom line. "It is a business," he said. "It is so purely a business that book publishing was the first enterprise in modern history to display all the crucial characteristics of capitalism." A few months later, the country elected Ronald Reagan president. Reagan's government did the opposite of what Senator Metzenbaum and the Authors Guild wanted. It loosened the barriers to consolidation and vertical integration. Magazine magnate Cy Newhouse bought Random House in 1980, building a media empire that included Condé Nast, and would soon add The New Yorker. The German conglomerate Bertelsmann acquired Doubleday in 1986 and took Random House off Newhouse's hands in 1998. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp swallowed Harper & Row in 1987, creating HarperCollins. The next year, Murdoch's rival, Robert Maxwell, the two were in the midst of a warring through British tabloids they owned, nabbed Macmillan. Simon & Schuster, at this point, had been on an extensive shopping spree with Gulf and Western money, accumulating profitable educational and professional publishing imprints, arriving, by 1991, at the position from which its president, Richard Snyder, could say with impressive frankness, "We are not a publisher, we are now a creator of copyrights for their exploitation in any medium or distribution system." Books were now content. Conglomerate authorship. But this book is not only a narrative of the conglomeration of publishing. It also tells how fiction was transformed. It transformed because conglomeration changed what it means to be an author. It would be a ridiculous exaggeration to say that authors are merely the humans attached to books to fulfill the legal requirements of authorship and the cultural expectations of creative originality. Yet, such an exaggeration is useful to break our habit of romanticizing authorship and begin, instead, to see the author through the Colophon's portal. The idea is that authorship is social and distributed widely. Some version of this picture has been advanced often by artists, critics, and theorists, though it has been difficult to sustain. Jack Stillinger devoted a book to the joint or composite or collaborative production of literary works that we usually think of as written by a single author, a phenomenon, he argues, that is extremely common. It is an editorial norm, established by Maxwell Perkins in the 1920s, to aim for invisibility, insisting that the editor only facilitates an author's vision, adding nothing of their own, no matter how false this often is. A good financial reason explains the dogma. As Abram Foley writes, corporate publishers have a vested interest in promoting their authors in such a way that the guiding hands of editors, publishing houses, marketers, and the market remain invisible. In corporate publishing, the author's name, more than the publishing house's colophon, is the most valuable sign. We tend to revert to the image of the solitary author, toiling away, in a cabin in the woods, at their cluttered desk in a book-filled room, to produce the text that arrives like a missive from their mind to ours. One version of the epiphenomenal author is the romantic author's obverse. Here, the writer becomes a vessel who channels something greater, culture, gods, tradition, the unconscious. Homer asks the muse to speak through him at the opening of the Odyssey. "Who is the poet?" asks Hugh Kenner in his study of modernism. "A medium?" The surrealists came up with practices like automatic writing and the game Exquisite Corpse to ease the artist's metamorphosis into a vessel. The poet Jack Spicer argues that the work of the writer is to get out of her own way so that she could let what he called Martians speak through her. The novelist Ruth Ozeki, a Zen Buddhist priest, hears voices who guide her writing. The musician Grimes, inspired by large language models that learn to imitate human writing after ingesting most of the scrapable internet, said, "We all kind of function like AI. We're all a product of all the content that we feed ourselves. And so it's just funny to be like, oh, this is my work. In reality, it's the result of thousands of years of human art making." Modern psychologists call the state that authors enter of total absorption that doubles as dissolution flow. In such states, the life of the author is not solitary, but suffused with social plenitude. A second version was advanced by French theorists in the 1960s. These theories were captured by their enthusiasm with the thought that the era inaugurated by modern philosophy and political liberalism might almost be over, that we might overthrow the concepts of rationality and of man, that we might transcend what they called the science of man or the social sciences. Major works in 1966 by the feuding Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault, the latter published by Schifrin at Pantheon in the United States in 1970, ended the same way, with prophetic trepidation that an epoch characterized by preoccupation with humanity was ending, that man might be erased like a face drawn in sand at the edge of the sea. Both were trying to persuade us that language as a system was more consequential than the pretense of individuals. The next year, 1967, their elder, Roland Barthes, penned a short, playful essay riffing, half in jest, on their self-serious ideas. "The image of literature to be found in contemporary culture," he lamented, "is tyrannically centered on the author, his person, his history, his tastes, his passions." This was bad theology, a reification of a much more interesting and complex process. He proclaimed, "It is language which speaks, not the author." The text, he said, is a tissue of citations, resulting from the thousand sources of culture. He called it the death of the author. A third version was propounded in the discipline of textual scholarship and began as a retort to the French theorists and their followers. Their obsession with language, argued Jerome McGann, left them oblivious to what he considered fundamental aspects of a text's meaning: its materiality and its sociality. He advocated attention to the physical form of books and manuscripts, paper, ink, typefaces, layouts, which others have extended to include tools. Think of Jane Austen's desk, Emily Dickinson's fascicles, George R.R. Martin's word processor. McGann posits texts as social acts. Many people work together to produce them. Literary production is not an autonomous and self-reflexive activity. It is a social and an institutional event. Such attention to the physical form of books and the people who produce them motivates the dynamic field of book history. John Young argues that textual studies have not gone far enough in decentering the author. Drawing on insights from African-American studies, Young asserts that an adequate analysis would incorporate the broader social dimension of a text, such as the racism that constrains the possibilities for all whose hands and minds shape it. Each of these formulations urges us to see the author as a portal through which collectives find expression. They challenge the notion that we can attribute a published work of fiction to a single individual. Authors access a world beyond their conscious selves. That world goes by different names: the unconscious, language, the imagination. The published author also channels the norms of a cultural system, its sense of literary value. She forges a commodity that will appear attractive to scouts, agents, editors, marketers, publicists, sales staff, booksellers, critics, and readers. Its attractiveness depends.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?